Each year we run a program geared for people who are involved in assemblies and churches, both full-time and lay people who are involved in various aspects of Christian ministry. And this program, we used to call our three-week program. It actually ran from Monday right through 1 week, through the weekend, which we had a marriage enrichment, right through the next week, then we have the weekend off, and then we'd have till Friday the following week. So there was actually 18 days of lectures. We've cut it down a little bit this year, and we've taken the marriage enrichment out of the middle and made those lecture days, and we've taken the days off out, so that the people are doing 14 days straight in study, and then we're putting the marriage enrichment on the end. So we've actually cut a whole week out and lost 2 days. In lectures, so you'll just have to take my word for that, you know, because you won't work that out mathematically. But we'd like to draw this to your attention. This year our special guest speaker is Dr. Arch Hart from Fuller Seminary, and he will be speaking during the second week of our program. The rest of the course is taken by some of our own staff, Ian Murray, myself, and others who are involved in teaching counselling. We look at various aspects of counselling, and we look at a lot of personal enrichment type stuff as well. So if you're interested in chatting to me about it, I'd be glad to talk to you over afternoon tea. We haven't had a lot of people from Sydney come down and do the course over the years. It's been running for about 9 years, but we have had some, and some are here today. So couldn't have been too bad if they came back for more. But it's really a wonderful course. It's changed lots and lots of people's lives in all sorts of ways, and we would love to share it with you sometime. So that's on, and it starts this year on the 15th of June. It's a bit earlier than usual. I was going to start this session this afternoon by dialoguing with my wife about a few things, but my wife has disappeared. I'm hoping she's not raptured, because that puts the rest of us in trouble. It serves yourself right for being a closet amillennialist, I suppose. Otherwise you'd have gone too. But if she does happen to come back, if she realises she's forgotten me and comes back, then we'll dialogue later when she does. But our subject that we're going to be talking about is relationships in tension. How to improve our relationships with others. But I wanted to look at three types of relationships. I wanted to look at relationships in tension, relationships in pain, and relationships in conflict. And I've divided them into those three because I want to get you to think about three different types of relationships that we may need to rebuild in our lives, whether they be in our marriages and family, or whether they be in the church or in work situations. The first of all were relationships in tension, and I suggested to you that there are a number of types of tension that relationships feel. One you could call cultural and social tension. That is, tensions that are caused between people because of cultural differences and social differences. And so there are some people that we find it more difficult to relate to because they just see things differently, or because they have a different background, or because they value things differently to us. And the tension that we feel between people like that is often expressed in terms of distance. We don't let ourselves get as close to people with whom we have cultural and social tensions as we might to someone that we don't have that cultural difference with. And of course that's an experience the world has had forever and a day, that many of the tensions that have existed between people have had to do with different cultural backgrounds. Our friend from Ghana, his name is Solomon, was sharing with me before how the church in Ghana is going through tensions in relation to ladies wearing slacks and women wearing head covering in church, and made the comment to him that Ghana just happens to be a few years behind Australia. I remember, I'm old enough to remember when we were going through all those tensions too. But he made the comment that some of that is very deeply rooted in the cultural situation and some of the tensions that they will feel as the church develops through those things will be the tension between what is biblical and what is cultural. And there isn't any doubt about it that a number of you here will understand what I'm talking about really well. So that's one type of tension. Another tension is the tension between authority and submission. Australians tend to experience this tension in relationships fairly frequently. They tell us that Australians have a problem with authority. That there is inbuilt into us a reason to fight authority or to reject authority or to struggle with authority. They put it down to our convict heritage, I think. Well, I don't know about that. I don't even know whether I have a convict heritage. I haven't been game to trace it back. In fact, I'd be lucky to get back that far before I found a convict, I think. But the interesting thing is that many Australians do seem to have a problem with authority. We talk about them and us. Whether it be in a high school, where the them is the principal and the vice principal, whether it be at work, where it's the boss and the manager, or whether it be in the church, where it's the elders. There's always a them, and we seem to have a problem with the them, and there's a tension between the them and the us when it comes to authority. I think of all the jokes we have about mother-in-laws, and I wonder whether some of that doesn't reflect some of the hostility that the men have traditionally felt toward having to wrench the daughter away from the person who's been the authority in her life up till then. But we always have some sort of problem with authority. Then there's a tension between generational tension, a tension across the age gap and the older people and the younger people having tensions in churches and families. I was absolutely convinced as I grew up that there was no age gap, no tension in that area between my father and myself. And I don't know if you're 50 years of age or more as you think back whether you can pick up that same age gap that we seem to pick up today. But it just didn't seem to be there then. And when I became a Christian, we didn't have a youth group. We had young people's activities that all the oldies came to. And we had other activities that we went to. There just wasn't any division. And I remember one stage they took a vote to see whether the young people wanted to have something separate, and the young people all voted against having something separate and voted for the oldies always to come. Can't imagine that happening today, but that happened a long time ago. And it was very exciting. I grew up, some of my best friends were my father's age as we related to them in the Christian environment. I don't seem to remember an age gap. But there seems to be a very strong tension between the generations today. And a lot of aggressiveness and anger that seems to develop. Then there's theological and doctrinal tension. We know all about it in the church, don't we? I jokingly said before that we'd all been left behind because we were closet amillennialists, but nevertheless there is a lot of tension between Christians who hold different doctrinal views. Actually, I have discovered as I've travelled around, most of the problem isn't between major doctrines at all. In fact, if you were to take the major doctrines of the Christian church and you were to take a wide sweep across the denominations, you'd probably find there was a whole lot more agreement than you think. In fact, in most of the major issues, we are in agreement. But there are divisions around some of the interpretations of verses that surround some of those doctrines, and some of the interpretations we place on Scripture, and some of those divisions have become very hot and very fiery. And so whether you're a Calvinist or an Arminian or an amillennialist or a premillennialist or a panmillennialist that believes it'll all pan out in the end, or a promillennialist, if there's one I'm for it, regardless of what you are, you will know that there's a lot of heat in a lot of those arguments and a lot of those quarrels. And there's a lot of tension between people over doctrines and over theology. And then there's the tensions related to change. Some of us find that change is a stimulating thing. And if there isn't too much change taking place in our lives, we make it happen. Otherwise, we're afraid we'll fossilise. And we shift house every 3 years, or we shift job every couple of years because we like to bring about change. There's others of us who are terrified by change. We would be glad if the weather didn't even change. The whole idea of change fills us with anxiety. And whenever we go through a change, like a change of a house, or a change of a job, or a change of a church, it is terribly traumatic. And when a church goes through change, it's awfully traumatic, isn't it? I always say that if you want to find the insecure people in your church or the angry people in your church, all you've got to do is stand up tomorrow morning in church and announce that you're going to change the worship service from 11 o'clock to 9:30. And you'll find them all in one foul swoop. I remember when I first joined the Assemblies back in 1963 or 4, and I'd grown up in a Methodist background, and we joined the Assemblies, and I was there a little while, and they asked me to become an elder. And I was a fairly young elder, believe it or not, and I was a very enthusiastic one. And shortly after I joined, a big decision was made. It was decided that instead of having worship at 9:30 and church at 11, that they would switch it around. They'd have Sunday school at 9:30 and an adult Bible hour, and we would have teaching, and then we would all meet together for worship. Sounded a great idea to me. I was really enthusiastic about it. And the other elders, who'd been elders a long time, were so gracious that they allowed me to make the announcement. And I remember thinking, what tremendous guys. You know? They could have had the privilege of doing this. And here they are letting me do it. And just because I'm the youngest. And what I didn't know, the stupidest as well. And so I made the announcement with great enthusiasm. You've got no idea. I get really enthusiastic about these things, and I went to great lengths to tell the church why this was a great idea. And then as I was going down the aisle and out the back door to at the end of the service, because I'd also preached the sermon, a lady stepped out of the aisle, a little lady, just a little tiny lady, and her eyes were firing. And she said, "Young man, that's of the devil." And I said, "It is." And she said, "Yes, it is. It is." She said, "You know and I know that worship must come before service." Well, I didn't know that. Nobody had ever told me that in the Methodist church. So I decided there was some scripture I was missing out on and asked her if she could show me the chapter and verse, and she said she'd bring it next week, but she never did. But as I've grown older, I've realised that the thing that people get most upset about is not so much the issue, but just the fear of change. And if we understood that and we nurtured the people who were going through a fear of change, then we would deal with a lot of the tensions that exist in our churches. It's not so much that they are against the issue, but they are afraid of the change. So there are lots of relationships in tension. And I often feel when I go to churches, it's not so much that the churches are divided, it's not so much that there's people in the churches who hate each other or anything like that, but there's quite a lot of tension in the church. And these tensions tend to surface when a catalyst appears. And they may surface over the charismatic movement, or they may surface over choruses versus hymns, or they may surface over the pulpit in the middle of the church or the side of the church. This is terribly unbiblical here. And they can surface over almost anything. And I just wanted to say that very seriously today, because Because it seems to me that that's one of the big problems in the Christian fellowships in which we are, that we allow tensions to fester away and not really be dealt with. And it's important, I think, in churches for leadership, for elders and for those in leadership, to sense where the tensions are and to deal with them. We have a little church where I come from, just a membership of 100-odd, and with the emphasis on the odd, and we were formed out of about 7 different denominations came together to form this little fellowship. So that's why you know it's odd. Can you imagine 7 different denominations sitting down to discuss how you'd have communion? We even had one denomination there that didn't have communion, so they weren't interested in the discussion. But we had, that's how we started. Very interesting. But as we've gone through, we've had to confront lots and lots of little tensions of the ways things were done. You know, one little old Methodist lady who used to get very upset if the communion stewards didn't walk down the aisle together. I mean, God deserves the best, doesn't he? He really does deserve stewards to walk down the aisle together. She was very upset that they didn't do that. And so we had all this sort of thing going on, but little by little we were working them through. And we had one lady who was older, and she found change very, very difficult. She used to get very upset over every change that was introduced, and she used to stay away for a mandatory 3 weeks, and then she'd come back. But the church is 9 years old now, and I've learnt, and some of the other elders have learned, that if you spend some time with these people who have a difficulty with change, you can help them a great deal. And just recently we had a colossal change. We shifted our whole church service 10 kilometres down the road to another town because we lost the hall that we used to meet in. And that's a big change, isn't it? Just imagine you shifting 10 kilometres from where you are now. Imagine how many years it would take you to decide that. Well, we decided it one Sunday after church. Just like that. We're going to shift. And this little lady came to me after the service, and she looked at me, and her eyes were wide. She just couldn't believe what was happening. And she looked at me and she said, "Graham, is it all right?" And I said, Yes, Mrs. Leslie, it's all right. And she said, "Good. If you think so, then it's all right." Now, that's because of the hours and hours and hours over the years we have spent talking about change. And now when a change was thrust upon her that she couldn't avoid, she didn't have the time to think about it, as long as someone she'd learnt to trust thought it was all right, she could cope. Now I want to share with you that if we worked harder in our churches to work through the tensions that relate to change or to doctrinal differences or cultural differences, our churches would have far less conflict than they have today. But we have to take time. And it takes a lot of time to work with relationships in tension. One of the problems with relationships in tension is that the problems don't arise till the catalyst arises, so that people can float along in tension fairly well. You know why I know that so well? I've spent 16 years living in community. Julie and I have lived in a community. And you can't live in a community with tension very long, because the tension surfaces very quickly because there's lots of catalysts. You know, in the end, the catalyst can be the way you blow your nose. You know what I mean? Community is that tight and that close that after a while, almost anything can trigger off an under-earth tension. And so you learn not to live with tension. You have to. You have to confront tensions immediately and work through them. And that's been an important thing for me to learn. And then there are relationships in conflict. Relationships in conflict. This is much more obvious and much more visible. And I've written down three things here, three that are important. One is relationships and anger. There are some relationships where both people are angry. They're angry because of disappointment in the relationship. They're angry because they feel that the other one doesn't understand them, or the other one has hurt them, or the other one is deliberately doing things to hurt them.
and two people begin to get angrier and angrier. And angry relationships are very destructive relationships. For instance, nobody ever listens in an angry relationship. Have you noticed that when two people are angry at each other, they just talk and don't listen? You don't listen when you're angry, because you're not counting the other person as important when you're angry at them. When you're angry, all you need to do is win. When you're angry, all you need to do is to get an advantage and hold a position of advantage. You don't listen. You don't acknowledge a point when you're angry. You never hear an angry person say, "Well, you've got a good point there." See, you don't, do you? You never see angry people close to each other. They create distance, don't they? I mean, a husband, have you ever seen a husband put his arms around his wife and say, "Darling, I'm so angry at you I could hang you from the rafters"? He puts a bit of distance between them, and, you know, in the kitchen table as well. And he raises his voice, because anger creates distance. And or when you're angry, you create distance. So angry relationships are destructive ones. In angry relationships, we tend to change the subject often. A husband and a wife could be arguing about how to spend money, but it's not very long before he says, "You're getting more like your mother every day." Which has got absolutely nothing to do with money, is it? But because you're angry, it's important to attack. It's important to get advantage. It's important to take people down a bit. You can be discussing, a married couple can be discussing things and arguing hotly, and she says, "Well, I just think you're a big fat slob." I mean, what's that got to do with whether you buy a new car or not? Just buy a bigger car. And the truth is, it has nothing to do with whether you buy a car or not. The truth is that she's just angry, and she just wants to get even because she's losing ground. And so in angry relationships, we find a great deal of attack and a great deal of destruction. In angry relationships, we tend to grow apart. I've worked over the years many, many times now, so many times I feel sad when I think about it, with couples who have ended in divorce. We are listed in Melbourne as one of the counselling services to which people are sent for a mandatory counselling session after they file for divorce. So the divorce is all set, everything's going to happen, but to salve the government's conscience, they want them to have one counselling session. So, you know, they haven't talked to each other for a year, and very often when they come, only through their solicitors, and then they end up in your office together. And it's the time you feel most hopeless. You know, you just know that nothing can be done, nothing's about to happen, except they're just going to rip shreds off each other. And I am astounded, I really am astounded, at how angry two people who once looked in each other's eyes in a wedding service and said that they were marrying for better or for worse, how angry they can be with each other, and how destructive in that anger they can be. But you know, as I have talked to these couples, you know what I've discovered? Most people don't get divorced because of adultery or because of wife beating. You know why they get divorced? Because they just don't love each other anymore. And you know why they don't love each other anymore? Because they've strangled each other's love by destructive behaviour. And little by little, the anger grows and it chokes out the love. And it destroys the relationship. I have talked to people who've been divorced for 4 or 5 years, are remarried, now married someone else. You know what they've frequently said to me, "Graham, I think, as I think back, that I could still be married to that same person as happily as I am to the second person if we had known how to resolve the conflict between us." And the sad thing is that so many people get married without having any conflict resolution skills. We don't know how to resolve conflict. Many of the young people who are growing up in today's world never learn how to resolve conflict. They don't have to. If they fight about which channel they're going to watch and their sister wants to watch one and they want to watch the other, they just go into their bedroom and put on their own private telly. You don't even have to solve a problem. If you don't get on with your parents, you just run away and live in a flat. That today we don't major on conflict resolution, and then two young people get married, they don't have any idea how to resolve conflict. They end up angry with each other because of that. And the second thing I've got down here is relationships and fear. There is a lot of fear in relationships. There are some of us who've grown up with a great deal of fear of authority. I got a thought the other day, I don't know how true it is, but I'd like to float it past you just for interest's sake. When most little boys grow up, the major authority figures in their lives for the first 10 years are women. Ever thought about that? Father is away a great deal at work and most of the discipline is exercised by mum. When he goes to the health centre with his mother, the nurse is generally, most often, a woman. When he goes to kindergarten, the teacher is in Victoria anyway, most often a woman. When he goes to primary school, the teachers in his early classes are most often women. If he lives in a situation where he gets involved with the social welfare, most of the social welfare workers will come to pick him up will be women. If he gets picked up on the street by the community policing squad, it'll probably be a policewoman. And most of the people who are the authoritative figures in his life in the first 10 or 11 years will probably be women. Then when he goes to high school, he is already relating women to authority. And there's an anger often in the Australian male, I think. Not only toward authority, but often toward women too. And if it's not dealt with, as he grows up, by the time he gets married, he's going to have a love-hate relationship with his wife. On one hand, he'll love her and need her because of his need for love and his need for someone to be close to, his need for intimacy, his need for sexual fulfillment. But on the other hand, she is going to be the most significant woman in his life, and all the other significant women in his life were authority figures. Isn't that interesting? I wonder if that's true. Just a theory. And it's a theory behind why some men, I think, don't share easily with women, with their wives. Find it difficult to share their feelings. Find it difficult to share deeply with a woman. Find it difficult even to trust women, is because that's been their experience. Now, I don't know whether that's true. It's just an interesting theory. But I think that there's a lot of fear in some people as they grow up. Fear of authority figures. Fear of opposite sex. There are people who've grown up in relationships where they have had unpleasant relationships with the opposite sex. Maybe they have been sexually abused by a male, or in the case of a boy, a female. And they grow up with a lot of fear. There are others who grow up with fear of certain types of people. I had an awful fear of loud, middle-aged women. I think it's because I had always seen my teacher like that. And so as I grew up, I had a terrible fear of women like that. And I became a pastor of a church when I was 19, just 19 years of age. And I was sent to this little country church to be the pastor. And when I got there, the superintendent minister, who lived 30 miles away in another church, he said that the first job I had to take on was to be president of the Ladies' Guild. Well, you can laugh if you like, but that was the most terrifying experience of my life. And he said that it was necessary because they'd had three presidents of the Ladies' Guild in 3 months. They only met monthly. They'd all resigned because they couldn't cope, and so they asked me to do it. And the first Thursday afternoon that I had to go into those ladies, I felt like a lion in a den of Daniels. I just was terrified. And I lived with that fear for 2 years. I was president of the Ladies' Guild for 2 years. When I left, they gave me a lovely little presentation and a present. and a nice little speech, and they said that there were only two things that I hadn't learnt in those 2 years. One that a good ladies' guild president should know. One was I never learnt to bake a cake for the street stall, and apparently that's really letting the side down. And the other thing was that I never learnt to burst into tears at the right time. What they didn't know was how many times I burst into tears when I went home. That was the most terrifying experience. But so we grow up with fears in various directions. And then we find ourselves in a church, or in a marriage, or in a family situation with people who represent the sorts of people we're afraid of. And we begin to respond out of that fear. And one of the places that anger comes from is out of fear. When you're afraid, you get angry. And so some of the angry relationships are relationships that are angry because somebody in that relationship's afraid. Afraid of criticism, maybe. Afraid of being devalued. Afraid of being put down. All sorts of fear. And then I've written down here on your page, relationships and guilt. Relationships and guilt. There's two types of guilt, and you might like to write this down. There is what I call, what we call real guilt. That is, I feel guilty because I know I have done something wrong, and I feel a sense of guilt about that. The other one is imputed guilt. That is, I feel guilty because people have projected guilt onto me. Now, I don't have to talk to you about real guilt. You understand that. But it's probably important to say something about imputed guilt, because I think that many of us would probably realise, if we thought about it, that we do more things out of imputed guilt than we do out of nobler motivations. For instance, can you think of the times you've gone to a meeting and you knew that you shouldn't have gone, but you went because you felt a sense of obligation? And you've sat in that meeting all night thinking, I shouldn't be here. I'm only here because if I wasn't, I'd feel guilty. I remember in an assembly where I used to be, the church secretary got up one day and was trying to encourage more people to go to the Wednesday night prayer meeting. Now, I, at that point of time, didn't go to the Wednesday night prayer meeting because Wednesday night was one of the few nights I could be home with my family, and I was involved in Christian ministry, and so I used to take Wednesday night off. Felt guilty about that, guilty enough about that anyway, but he got up and he said this. He said, show me how many people go to your morning service, and I'll tell you how popular the church is. Show me how many people come to your night service, and I'll tell you how popular the preacher is. Show me how many people come to your prayer meeting, and I'll tell you how popular the Lord is. Well, I was so angry. I was seething. It's a wonder they didn't see the smoke rising from the back seat. Because, you see, that's the sort of guilt-producing stuff we've often done in church. We still cling a bit to the Roman Catholic concept of, if you've got people scared enough of you and guilty enough, you can keep them forever. And we try and get people to operate as a church by making them feel guilty. And I don't believe that that's the role of the church. And I believe you want to wreck relationships in the church. Make people feel guilty. Use guilt to manipulate them. Use guilt to hold them together, and you'll split them apart. Because guilt is not ever, it's not ever God's way. In Corinthians, 2 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul talks about guilt and godly sorrow. He talks about worldly sorrow and godly sorrow. The word that's used for worldly sorrow is the word we use for guilt and godly sorrow. And he says worldly sorrow leads to separation and death, and godly sorrow leads to repentance and life. People don't come to God out of guilt, they come to God out of godly sorrow. Guilt drives us apart. Guilt drives us away from the person. If you gossiped about me and you were feeling guilty about it, and I came into the room, the first thing you'd want to do is run. That's what guilt does. But if you gossiped about me and you were really sorry about it and I came into the room, the first thing you'd want to do is to come and tell me you're sorry. When I sin against God and I realise that in one sense I've crucified the Lord Jesus all over again, I am deeply moved with sorrow, and all I want to do is go to Him and say, Lord, I have sinned and I want You to forgive me. But if I let the devil get in and fill me with a whole lot of guilt, that guilt could drive me apart from God. Guilt doesn't draw us together, it drives us apart. What we have to be really careful of is to deal with guilt in our lives in terms of relationships. If as a husband you're carrying guilt around because of something that you've hidden from your wife, then that will make you, give you a heavy burden and make relationships particularly difficult. And then the third one is relationships in pain. And I'll run through this very quickly and then we'll stop and invite some questions. The first is the pain of withheld affection. Basically, most of us need affection. Now, as you think about that, I want you to stop and think about yourself and say, well, what about me? Do I need a lot of affection? Well, some of you will realise that you need to hear the people in your life tell you they love you from time to time. I think of the woman who said to her husband, their 25th wedding anniversary, darling, do you love me? And you never tell me that you love me. And he said to her, well, you've got a bad memory. I told you 25 years ago and I have no reason to change my mind. When I do, I'll let you know. But some women would die, shrivel up and die in that sort of situation. And we need to be told that we are loved. And for some of us, that's very important, not just women, but men too. And then others of us would say, well, we need touch. That as you think about the way you understand affection, touch is important to you. Some of us are touchy people, but touch is just important to us. We need the hug. We need the touch of the hand. We need some sort of physical indication that we are loved. And then there are others of us who, as we think about it, we think, well, as long as the person shows they appreciate me, you know. I don't really mind whether he ever tells me he loves me or not. I don't mind if he touches me or not. As long as he mows the lawns and washes the car and fixes the house and pays the bills, and I feel that he cares about me in that way. That's the way I like it. Well, we're all different. But in one sense, we all need affection. We all need affection to make us feel secure and to make us feel significant. But in a relationship where affection is withheld, then that can be very destructive. Some of you men will say, you know, I find it very difficult to show affection, but when I think about it, there was no affection ever shown in our family. Some of you will say that. Some of you women will say that. When we talk to people who find it difficult to show affection, many, many of them will say, we never really had affection shown in our family. We'd never know what it was for Dad to put his arm around me and say, son, I love you. Or, daughter, I love you. And if you've grown up in a family like that, that's pretty painful stuff. And then when you become a parent yourself, it's very difficult to break through that. Because the pain of withheld affection leaves its scar. And to start to be a loving person beyond that without the healing of God can be very painful. I know there are some men who are very, very expressive and can express love, and they didn't have fathers who could do it. But they were so hurt by the fact that their fathers couldn't express love that when they became Christians, they sought healing for that. And God freed them up so that they could express affection. I think that verse in the scripture that talks about the sins of the fathers visited on the first, second, third generations often relates to the angry father who is unable to express affection to his son, and his son grows up angry because he was starved of affection. And even though he wants to show his son affection, he can't do it because he's too angry. And so it can go on generationally, and that's really very sad. Then there's the pain of personal devaluation. If you've grown up in an environment where you were put down and criticised by a significant person in your life and devalued by that person, wasn't that painful? Gee, I don't know that anything hurts any more than having someone you really see as a significant person who criticises you and puts you down and devalues you all the time. Sarcasm, just all the time. And some people have grown up in families like that, and they're wounded people as a result of that. Not only do they have a bad self-esteem, but they're just wounded by the pain of being rejected through those sorts of comments. And I guess many of us need healing from that. Many of us need to get into the healing process so that God can remind us that He now is our Heavenly Father. He doesn't put us down. He loves us and He wants to embrace us. And He wants to minister to us. He wants to touch us. He wants to heal us. And that'd be a lovely thing for some of us to get into today. I meet lots of people who talk about having a bad self-esteem, and one of the first things I'll say to you is, I was always put down and criticised and devalued by a father or a mother or a teacher. And what a wonderful thing it would be if there were people like that today who were able to say, look, I'm going to go to God before this day's out, and I'm going to tell Him how much it hurt, and I'm going to ask for the grace to forgive my parents for that, and I'm going to ask Him to heal my heart of that pain. Because you see, if we don't, we tend then to relate out of that pain and we tend to hurt others. So the pain of devaluation. And the last one is the pain of rejection. There are some counsellors who think that everybody's psychological and relational illness has to do with rejection. Well, there's some books written about that, but don't believe it. It's not true. Rejection is only one of the painful experiences of life. Certainly a very painful one. And it does hurt deeply. And a relationship that experiences rejection is a relationship in great pain. We can experience rejection in all sorts of ways. Sometimes husbands feel rejected by their wives because their wives no longer want to share intimacy within the relationship. There are wives who feel rejected by husbands because the husbands never seek their opinions about anything anymore. There are spouses who feel rejected by each other because they never share deeply with them. There are young people who feel rejected by their families because their families don't approve of things they've done. Rejection can be very painful, and some of us are a lot more sensitive to rejection than others, aren't we? Some people you couldn't reject if you tried. Sometimes they, you take a person with a good, healthy self-esteem and a thick skin, and they walk into their place of employment and their workmates are whispering in a corner, and their workmates stop whispering as they come in. What does that person think? He thinks, oh gee, they're planning my birthday party, yeah. But if a person with a bad self-esteem came into that circumstance, they say, oh, they're talking about me. Yeah. So some people are really hard to reject. Others you can reject by blowing your nose the wrong way because they're really sensitive to that. They've been hurt like that. And some husbands will find themselves married to women who are very easily rejected. Some men, women find themselves married to men who just get rejected so easily. And a lot of that has to do with the pain of past rejection, and it's being projected into their relationship. Let's stop there. Any questions anybody's got about those things? Do ask them. Don't be afraid. I think when you point that gun, they all go nervous. Any questions at all? You must have some.
I have one.
Good on you.
It's to do with what you said about going along to a meeting and feeling angry and saying, I shouldn't have been.
Yes.
Don't we also have a responsibility to... we have a responsibility to those that we fellowship with?
Yes.
Yeah, I will repeat that question because it's a very important one. It has to do with this projected guilt thing, and Sue was saying that we can feel guilty because we go to things sometimes out of guilt, but don't we have an obligation to those we fellowship with to be there?
Please turn the tape over at this point.
But don't we have an obligation to those we fellowship with to be there? Yeah. I think there's a very big difference between doing something because I'm really committed to it and I really feel strong obligation to it, and doing something because I carry a sense of guilt about not doing it. Guilt is the thing that says, I don't really want to be there, I'm not really even obligated to be there, but if I don't go, what will they think? You see, and I think it's a very different thing. I can think of times when I've been just deadbeat and I've decided not to do something that I normally do, and I've really had to wrestle with a feeling of guilt about that decision, and that's what is called imputed guilt. But I think it's different than an obligation. If I'm doing something because I feel a responsibility to do it, I'll feel fairly good about that. But if I'm doing it because I feel guilty, I will not feel good about it, and I probably won't do it all that well either.
I remember thinking about this last year, since coming from a small assembly, not so small, but lots of responsibilities, and I was talking to Ian Murray at lunch, and you know, really struggling about this, and he said, "Do you think, Vivian, that you know, if you're not there, that they will survive?" Well. Yeah, they probably would, you know, if I had to move or if I was sick or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I guess it's this pride thing of thinking, gee, I have to be there.
Yeah.
The place will fall apart if I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of the time we just feel like that.
Yeah.
It's wrong.
And if you think about it, as you grow up, there's a lot of imputed guilt going on. Like, you know, kids sometimes get the message from dad, well, if you don't behave yourself, your mother will get sick. You know, that sort of stuff. Or, no wonder she's got a cold, you know. Putting up with you kids. You see. Or mum drops the milk and the first thing she does is say, look what you made me do. The poor kid goes, and in various ways we lay guilt on each other. And it's very easy to end up absorbing that guilt so that you end up feeling guilty for everything. I meet some people I met one dear old lady who would read something in the paper about some crime, and within days of reading it would feel guilty, feel that she had actually committed it. And police will tell you about people who ring up and actually dob themselves in for crimes they haven't committed because they are now neurotically guilty because of imputed guilt. So it's a very real thing. It's something a lot of people experience. Yes.
Do you see any relevance between low self-esteem of Christians and the theological teaching of the fact that we're worms in the gutter and the view of pride?
The question for those down the back is, do I see any connection between the fact that a lot of Christians seem to have a bad self-esteem and the fact that there's a sort of theological teaching that we're all worms and have no value? The hymn that says, oh, that he should die for such a worm as I. I'm not sure. I think that sort of theology can sometimes consolidate what is already there. And I think a lot of people become Christians because it really is a way of giving myself a bad time at the same time as being a good person. And it's the stage is well set for continuing on in bad self-esteem. I think we should be preaching a lot more that we are children of the King, and that we have a new value because we have been redeemed and because the image in which we were created has been restored. And I think we should be preaching that and teaching that a great deal more, because
that would help. But you know what I think about bad self-esteem? Let me tell you what I think about bad self-esteem. I think that bad self-esteem is a sort of pride. Pride is when I believe, and I'm trying to make everybody else believe, that I'm the very best. Self-esteem is when I believe, and I'm trying to make everybody else believe, that I'm the very worst. So I can't be the very best, then I could be the very worst. One way or the other, I'm not going to be average. And one way of dealing with self-esteem, you know, I tried hard with self-esteem. I have tried hard for years. I am a counsellor who's going to confess to you that I am an absolute failure when it comes to bad self-esteem. At least I was till a couple of years ago. Because I used to try to talk people who had a bad self-esteem into a good self-esteem. And I would say, but, you know, you really are very attractive. But you're very clever. And it didn't matter what you did. You can't talk a person with a bad self-esteem into a good one. And I'd say, but you're a Christian and you're a child. Oh, yeah, but I took Jesus to die on the cross. Oh, that's bad. And just, you just didn't make any headway. And people with bad self-esteem, and they read the Bible, they read all the verses about judgment and losing your salvation and being condemned and committing the unforgivable sins, and you just don't make any headway. And so one day I decided, I've got to give up. This is no way. And so I tried to find a new way, and I found a new way. And this is what it is. When somebody says to me, you know, I'm worthless and useless and dumb, I say yes. You're right. In fact, you're probably dumber than you think you are. Now listen, because I know I'm speaking to people with self-esteem and you're feeling angry with me, right? Bad self-esteem, you're feeling angry with me right now. I don't use that as a technique. You see, that's the truth. And unless you start with the truth, you can't go anywhere. And the way to deal with bad self-esteem is to start with the truth, and the truth will set you free. The truth is, I feel I am the lousiest, dumbest, rottenest person around here, and what I have to do is come to grips with the truth. If that's the truth, I've got to accept it. And then I start with the truth. What hope is there for someone as dumb and as stupid and as worthless as me? Well, the first hope is that God loves me. That's the first hope. He doesn't love me despite what I am. He loves me because of who He is. You know, people come along and say, well, what if you are so stupid and dumb and worthless? God loves you anyway. That really doesn't do a lot for you, does it? Well, it doesn't for me anyway. I said, well, so He would. He's God. But when someone comes along and says, you know, God loves you because of who God is, I feel I just want to throw my arms around a God like that. And he made me the way I am, and He loves me, and He's going to fulfill my potential. But I have to start with the truth, and the truth is how I feel about me. And then I work out from there. I don't try to talk a person into a good self-esteem. I accept what they believe about themselves. And then we say, what hope is there for a person who feels that? Well, there's lots of hope. One is that God loves you. Two is that He's redeemed you. Three is He's now given you some gifts. I wonder what they are. I wonder how come you haven't recognized what the gifts are that God has given you. Let's spend some time finding out what they are. And then when we spend some time finding out what the gifts that God has given are, we move on to whether we're using those gifts or not. Then if we were using those gifts, would we feel as dumb and as silly as we feel now? And what about the things that God's freed us up to do, like forgiving the people who's made us feel dumb and loving the people who we've never loved before and accepting the people who are just like us? You know, a whole range of new life opens out when you start with the truth. That's why Jesus said, you'll know the truth and the truth will make you free. You've got to start with the truth. No good telling people something they think's a lie. No good telling them they are attractive. They don't believe that. No good telling them they're clever, they don't believe that. I know met a lady in America, Julie and I met a lady in America, a beautiful lady. She was one of the most beautiful women I had ever seen in my life. She was stunningly attractive. And she was married to this stunningly handsome pastor. And when we arrived at this place to do the course, you know, everybody sort of paled into insignificance when this couple turned up. They were just that sort of what you expected to see in the Women's Weekly. You know, just, ooh, they had everything. Absolutely everything. And they told us about they had twin sons and in their teens, and they just had everything. They had a big church, and she was musical. She just sat down and the piano talked. They were fantastic. And Julie just happened to be in the same group as this lady, and when she started to share in the group, she shared how she hated herself. And how when she looked in the mirror, she couldn't believe how ugly she was. She really believed that. Why? Because she was born to a father who wanted a boy. And right up to that little girl was 5 years of age, the father used to tell her how dumb and ugly and stupid she was. And then when she was five, he died. And she was left with that belief system and this incredible anger at a man who would do that and then have the indecency to die before she could get her own back. And so she punished herself for the rest of her life. There's no good saying to that lady she was beautiful. You had to start with the truth. And the truth was she believed herself to be ugly and worthless and useless. And then to start with, what hope is there for a person like me? You try that. If you're battling with bad self-esteem, you just try that. But you see, the resistance to trying that is that a lot of people with a bad self-esteem don't want to change. You know why they don't want to change? Because if they change, they won't be the worst anymore. And therefore, there's no significance in being average. And so they don't want to shift. They lock themselves in and they resist any change. And that's why I want to encourage you, if you've got a bad self-esteem, start with the truth. The truth that you believe about yourself and the truth about God. And the truth is that God, because of who He is, loves you enough to open up a whole new life to you if you want it. But you've got to want it. Sorry, that's a long answer to your... Whose question was it? Somebody. Sorry about that. Anybody else got a question? Promise not to take so long. Solomon.
Is there anything like holy anger?
Holy anger. Is there anything such as holy anger? There is a phrase in Scripture called righteous indignation. And interpreted literally, it means to hate and love at the same time. Now, my feeling about that is God's the only one who can do that. He demonstrated that at the cross. He hated sin and He loved the sinner intensely at the same time. And as I said, I think God is the only one who can do that. Now, I do believe that there are times when we are upset on behalf of others. And we are angry on behalf of others. And as I look at some social issues in the world, I feel very angry on behalf of others. But again, I have the same responsibility to deal with that anger appropriately as I have when it's my own selfish anger. And I must decide what I'm going to do with that. And I think if we take an anger like that and we use it in a positive way to improve the situation or to open up an understanding of the situation to us, then I think that's appropriate. So I don't know that I call it holy anger, but I think there is an anger on behalf of others. I think it often motivates people to do great things. All the great reformers have been motivated by anger on behalf of others, or many of them have. And I think that that's appropriate, but I think we still need to use it appropriately. There have been other people who've been motivated by anger. They feel on behalf of others who've actually murdered or sinned in some dreadful way as a result. And I think we still have the same responsibility to deal with it appropriately.
Yes, down the back.
Talk about relationships and guilt. What are the means by which you can assure service in imputed guilt?
Right. The only thing that I know that has worked for me is that whether guilt is real or imputed, I believe Jesus died for both. Because I can feel just as condemned by imputed guilt as I can by real guilt. And it seems to me that the only way I can ever deal with it is put both of those under the work of Christ and say, Jesus died for the unreal guilt as well as the real guilt. And to accept his absolute forgiveness and freedom. If forgiveness means setting someone free, then I believe I can set myself free by forgiving myself for the things I am genuinely guilty about and for the things that I don't have to be guilty about, but I am. And I can release myself by not only accepting God's forgiveness, but by forgiving myself for those things. Let me give you an example of that. I remember meeting a mother who had a retarded child. And the mother, for I think the wrong reasons and wrong thinking, had accepted guilt for the fact that the child was retarded. Nothing that you could do would convince her that wasn't so. But the way she dealt with it in herself and the way she got the victory through it was that eventually she said, whether I have a right to be guilty or not, I feel guilty. And the only way I can deal with it is ask God to forgive me for that sense of guilt, for that feeling guilty, and set me free. And she did that, and she got the freedom. Now, I would have wanted to argue with her, and I wanted to say, but you don't have to be forgiven for something you haven't done. But she did need to. That was the only way she could get free, was to be forgiven for that. And in one sense, by harbouring that guilt, she was actually sinning against herself. By harbouring imputed guilt and letting that work in our lives, we really are sinning against ourselves. So it's probably a good thing to be forgiven for it in that sense. Someone else there was? Yes.
The social reaction of anger that you were talking about,
yeah.
You would not classify that as sin.
No, I wouldn't. The first reaction of anger that we feel is usually, if it's valid anger, it's usually a physiological upsurge of feeling. Now, there are times when it's not. Let me say that I think there's such a thing as inappropriate anger. If I am negotiating with somebody and I'm not getting my own way, and I get into anger because my own selfish desires are not being met, then I believe that's a response I've got control over if I want to. And so therefore I think that is fairly early in the piece, that sin. But I think where I'm angry over something I've seen or felt or so on, and it's been an impulse, the sin comes when I deal with that anger the wrong way. Anybody else? Good. Well, let's have a look then at how to improve these relationships. The relationships in tension, the relationships in conflict, and the relationships in pain. Four things that will help us. Number one, know yourself. Let me ask you a question, and you answer it. Write down the answer for yourself. How do you cope with change? Is change easy or difficult for you to cope with? Just write down easy or difficult. Or are you frightened by change? Do you cope with change by running away from it? Do you cope with change by becoming aggressive? Do you cope with change by becoming fearful? How do you respond to change? Good thing to jot that down. It would be helpful for you later. Know yourself. Some of you will write down, no, I love change. But some of you will write down that change is difficult. How do you cope with conflict? What happens
when you're caught up in conflict? Do you jump into the conflict like a shark and fight the issue and, you know, you really want to win? Is that the way you cope with conflict? Or do you stick your head in the sand and hope the conflict will go away? If I don't notice, it'll go away. Or do you say, well, the issue isn't important as long as everybody loves me when it's over? How do you deal with conflict? We sometimes talk about the teddy bear as the person who is into people and not into issues and just won't argue. The turtle is the person who sticks his head in, pulls his head in, hopes it'll go away. And the shark is the person who wants to fight and win. Church has got plenty of white pointers, haven't they? And, you know, you might think about your partner here, your spouse, and say, oh, yeah, they're a shark. Or they're a teddy bear. Or they're a turtle. Well, don't think about them, think about yourself. What do you do when conflict comes along? Run away, fight, or pretend it's not there. Know yourself. How do you deal with fear? When you're afraid that somebody's going to reject you, or you're afraid that people are going to hurt you, or something that's very special to you is going to be lost, how do you act when you're fearful? Some people get very angry when they're fearful. Very aggressive. Watch a little fox terrier when a big German shepherd is about to come in the front gate. What does he do? As long as he's got the fence between him, he'll jump up and down and yip his little head off. Because he hopes by getting angry, he'll frighten the big dog away. If the big dog comes in, it might be a different story. So, do you use anger when you're fearful, aggressiveness? Or do you withdraw when you're fearful, go silent? What do you do when you're afraid? Do you try to manipulate people when you're afraid? What do you do when you're guilty, when you feel guilty? How do you deal with guilt? Do you bury it? Do you confess it? Do you own it? Can you say to your husband or your wife, yes, dear, you're right, I'm wrong? Hard to say I'm wrong, is it? How do you deal with guilt? And how do you deal with anger? Do you attack people verbally when you're angry? Or physically? Do you withdraw when you're angry? When we got married, one of the things we were going to dialogue about, when we got married, Julie and I had two very different ways. I used to get very noisily angry and want to resolve things as quickly as we could, usually my way. And Julie used to go silent and wash up loud. And one way or another, we communicated to each other that we were angry. What do you do when you're angry? Okay, know yourself. You see, if you know those things about yourself, you can take a big step toward healing a damaged relationship. Because you know immediately what contribution you've made to that damaged relationship. You know that if you're married to somebody who can't cope with you going silent, you've helped to damage the relationship by going silent. Or if you're married to somebody who goes silent, and you're a noisy person when you're angry and you yelled and slammed doors, and you've contributed to the broken relationship by being aggressive. If you know yourself, you know what contribution you're making to that damaged relationship, and that's very important. You're not ready to heal the relationship till you own what part you've had in it. Once you've done that, you're one big giant step forward. The second thing, and I can't emphasize this enough, is to learn to listen beyond your bias, beyond your prejudice, beyond your preconceived ideas, and beyond your fear. learn to listen to the person that you're building the relationship with. And the question that I have to ask you is, what sort of a listener are you? Okay? Most of us would have to say, even those of us who are counsellors, would have to say, not too good. Listening is one of our poorest skills. Let me tell you about some of the different sorts of listeners. Some people listen, that you could call them cue listeners. That is, that they listen to a person until they hear them say something that reminds them that they've got something to say. Right? You can tell a cue listener. I bet you can tell a cue listener. When you're talking to them, they get that look in their eye. Sort of a glazed, I have tuned out look. But all they're waiting for is for you to take a breath. And as soon as you take a breath, they'll jump in and start talking about themselves. Sometimes we Christians are, you know, slightly better than that. We don't jump in and start talking about ourselves. We jump in and give them a solution to their problem. They might have only been talking for 30 seconds. But that's long enough. I know the answer. I've got just the verse. Well, you'll never heal a relationship like that. We only heal relationships when we listen deeply. Other people listen in order to win an argument. And they only listen for as long as they need to listen till they see a chink in the other person's armour. And then they want to talk. That's not the sort of listening that heals relationships. You will only heal a relationship if you know how to listen deeply to another person's anger, to another person's ideas, to another person's fear, to another person's feelings. And I can tell you that one of the things I really had to learn, and the hardest thing I had to learn when Julie and I needed to work through conflict, was how to listen. Julie used to go silent and I used to say, you've got to talk, you can't resolve anything unless you talk. And we'd go to bed and we'd be in bed till 2 o'clock in the morning and she'd be laying there silent and I'd be saying, speak, oh, you've got to talk, got to talk, got to talk. So finally she would talk. And it would all come out, you know, sort of angry and attacking, and then I'd say, that's not true. And she'd say, there you are, what's the use of talking? And she's right. What's the use of talking if you don't listen? The only way you're going to help a person come through conflict is to listen them, listen to them, whether what they say is unjust and unfair and wrong, you've still got to listen. And if it means wearing all their anger until you feel like you're going to be suffocated, you've got to wear it. And if you do, you will lead them out of conflict. It works every time. If you really listen to a person as they share their pain and you respond to that and let them see that you believe their pain is valid and they have a right to be hurt if that's the way they understand it, and if that's the way they see it, they've got every right in the world to be hurt. If you let them feel that, they'll start to come out of their conflict. But if you don't, they'll be locked in it. And I want to encourage you, learn to listen. Practice listening every chance you get. And when a person's angry and you go to a person and say, look, obviously there's something going on between us, I'd like to resolve it, then be prepared to resolve it by giving them the invitation to talk first and then saying, listen, I'm prepared to sit here for as long as it takes to hear you say everything you need to say. And then when they've said everything they need to say, we need to be able to say to them, hey, this is what we heard. I heard that you feel this. I heard that you feel that. I hear that you're feeling that. And then when they know that you've heard, most of the steam will go out of that conflict. So learn how to listen and be a good listener. The other side of that is if you're in conflict and you need to talk, then you need to find someone who's a good listener. Every wise man or woman will have amongst their friends someone who is a good listener. If you can't think of a good listener among your friends, go out and find one. As quick as you can. Because somewhere down the track, you're going to need someone who's a good listener.
Do you know why lots of people in churches go to professional counsellors? Because they can't find anyone to listen to them unless they pay them to do it. And that's a sad indictment on the church. It's a sad indictment on us as Christians that we are such bad listeners. I am very sensitive to listeners because that's my job. But when I'm talking to people, I'm very conscious of the level at which they listen. And I have been hurt many a time when I have needed someone to talk to. And I have begun to talk and I have found that they were not willing to listen. And I remember one occasion and time when I was going through that awful time called midlife crisis. And I needed somebody to talk. I had doubts and fears and anxieties that I had never had in my life before. And I had depression that I never experienced in my life before. And I needed someone to talk. And every Christian that I went to wanted to tell me what was wrong with me. And they wanted to tell me what Bible, what verses I should be reading. And what principles I should be applying. I knew all them. I knew them better than they did. I didn't need answers. I needed someone to listen. And I could not find a person to listen until I, a professional counsellor, was prepared to make an appointment with another professional counsellor. That was the only way I could find someone to listen to me deeply. And I want to tell you, if that's true of the churches in Sydney, that's an indictment on them. Many a person comes to us at Elkanah and says, the only reason I'm here is I cannot find anybody that will listen to me in my church. Yes, good. Thank you. I think sometimes it's because we're either shy or we've built up this belief that you can't talk about your own problems in your own church. I think there's a lot of that. But I really do think that we've developed a way of relating in church communities that does not include listening as a high priority. Who are the people we make a big fuss of in the church? It's the upfront people. It's the confident people. It's the singers and the preachers and the leaders and the organisers and the administrators. And we haven't made a big thing of the listeners. We haven't sort of seen that as a big priority. And our church programs don't allow for it. We don't have a lot of time for people to share deeply with each other. Probably the only real times might be cell groups. And some lovely things happen in cell groups where groups learn to listen. But even there's often one or two people who can't listen and they foul up the rest. So I think we probably haven't put a priority on listening. And we haven't trained people to listen. And I've developed a course that I run now for nurses and people who are in professions on listening as a therapy. How you can move a person from point A to point B by doing nothing else but listening. Nothing else. And it'd be great to see people in churches really working on that. In fact, I was saying to Peter yesterday that I think when we teach a pastoral care course, we should be teaching, 85% of what we should be teaching is how to listen therapeutically. Because I think that we need that desperately. Good. Peter.
Do you think perhaps that lack of listening within the church has something to do with the tensions in the relationships?
Yes, I'm sure. I'm sure it does. And those tensions, amongst other things, create intolerances and create fears, and also there's a the thought in the church that the most useful Christian is the one who's got the answer. And there's this tremendous, if I stopped now and turned you into couples and said, I want one of the couple to talk about a problem for 3 minutes and the other one to listen. When we stopped and I got feedback from the listeners, the most common thing that the listeners would say is, my biggest temptation was to interrupt and say, have you thought about doing this? Why don't you do that? What about this verse? Because we really are very much, you know, committed to that. So my answer, I think the thought would be that that is one of the reasons, but the other reason is I think that we're very committed toward giving an answer, and that answer comes from our point of view, you know, and which is important.
An aspect in the fact that we haven't been taught to disclose.
Yes.
There's very much the facade and the face,
yes,
and that people bring to church, and we wear it ourselves. And even if you do listen, sometimes that person is not able to to disclose.
Yeah, I think you're right too. That the comment down here was that we haven't learned how to disclose, and it's true that we're not really good at opening up. My feeling is, however, when somebody is in enough pain, they often do look around for someone to listen. And they're not going to experiment when they're in pain, so that they tend not to take the risk. There may be some people in churches who could do it, but they have not found them before and they haven't demonstrated before. And I think that's why I'd be inclined to be developing people in the church. I don't know what you would call them, but one of the things I wouldn't call them is counsellors. But I would be wanting to build up in a church that I was in two or three people who are known to have done special training in therapeutic listening. And I'd let the congregation know they were there, and they'd obviously be demonstrating some of their skills in just their casual relationships. And I think you'd be amazed how often they'd be used. And I think you'd be more amazed at how often that they would be just as useful and just as successful as a paid counsellor, professional counsellor. So I lean toward training people to do it. But you're right, we're not taught how to disclose either. Very quickly then, moving on to the third one. The third way of improving relationships with others is to learn to explore another's point of view. Let me give you a little thing that's worth thinking about listening. Listen and explore, not listen and respond. Got that? Listen and explore, not listen and respond. Often we listen and respond, right? We listen and then we jump in with a comment, or we jump in with an answer. But if you listen and explore, what that means is I listen and then I say, yeah, obviously you feel very strongly about that. Or, yeah, you're obviously very angry about that. You know what I mean? Explore it a bit further. See, if that happened to me, I guess I'd be feeling pretty angry too. Open up the doors so that people can explore it a bit further rather than respond to it. Because in most people are the resources to find answers. Let me say that again. In most of the people you will listen to who've got a problem are already the resources to find the answers. They know the Bible. Many of them know the Bible as well as you. Better. One of the things that Bruce Naramore said, and I'll never forget this, is very helpful. He said, never tell a person something they already know in a counselling situation. That's a good bit of advice. So I never say to a person, well, you know what Romans 8 says, don't you? If I want to draw their attention to something God has said, I might say, what do you know that verse in Romans 8, 23. What does that say to you? What do you make of that? And let them explore it. Let them struggle with it. Because if you explore things with people, you'll find you give them the courage to face up to the answers they already know are there. Or you give them the courage to face up to asking the questions they're too afraid to ask. So explore, don't solve the problem. And if you're in a marital situation and your spouse is angry, when they express their anger, stop and explore it with them. Say, hey John, I guess that's the first time I really heard you say that. I know you've said it before, but That's the first time it's ever I've ever really listened to that. What do you mean by that? Or, well, let's talk more about that. Now, after he gets up off the floor and in disbelief, he'll be excited. He'll know he's being listened to. And it's a terribly helpful thing to do. Learn to explore another's point of view. And the last one, accept the inevitability of diversity. You've just got to accept that most people are going to be different from you. And in any group of people, there's going to be a large diversity. And that's okay, isn't it? It's all right if people don't think the same as you. I read a comment the other day and I don't agree with it. It was made by an evangelical Christian, and I'd like to talk to him about it. And the comment was, there can be no revival when there are two pastors who don't agree, or two lay people who don't agree, or two halves of a church that don't agree. Garbage. There'll always be diversity. There will be no revival where two people can't love each other and forgive each other and accept each other, and where we can't accept each other across the diversity. But diversity itself should not be a divisive thing. One of the lovely things about marriage when you've been married for 28 years is the freedom to live with each other knowing that you think different about some things. And we've watched the faces of people sometimes when we've been in conversation with them and I've said something, Julie said, honey, I don't agree with that. And, you know, you watch people say something, they look at you as if, ooh, going to be an argument. I'm really glad that Julie doesn't agree with everything I think. And I don't agree with everything she thinks either, and she's glad about that. Because in that diversity, there's a special sort of strength, a special sort of security, because I know I'm not married to a yes person. And it's the same in a church. There's a certain security about knowing that there's a bit of a diversity if you're prepared to accept that. But the trouble with some assemblies and the trouble with some churches is we've tightened the boundaries so tightly that there's no room for diversity. We're all the same. And if you're not the same, you don't stay. And that's really sad. And my prayer is that we will soon see a real movement in our churches and our assemblies where we can rejoice in diversity and get encouraged by it rather than be hurt by it. So accept the inevitability of diversity. Even in marriage. I mean, one of the reasons you got married was you were different. Then you spend the rest of your life trying to change your spouse and make her like you. You see? And like when we got married, I was very untidy. And I was just untidy. That was me. I had a theory that if when you got out of your trousers, if you left them on the bedroom floor, where you got out of them, there's a fair chance in the morning that if you jump right, you could land in them. And that would save a whole lot of time. But do you think Julie appreciated that? She had this silly idea about it was save time to hang them up. You ever tried to get into a pair of trousers hanging on a clothes hanger? Doesn't save time at all, but I could never convince her of that. And but it really, there was diversity. She was tidy and I was untidy. As time has gone on, we've compromised a bit. I'm a little tidier than I was. She's a little untidier than she was. And we've compromised and we get on perfectly well. But we're not the same. We'll never be the same. And that's okay. We have to learn to accept the inevitability of that. Well, it's 3:00. Any questions before we stop for afternoon tea? We've done nothing but eat today. Yes?
Only one point, Graham, and that is that it seems that a lot of married couples today, and I'm thinking in reference to those where there's problems, aren't prepared to accept each other as different.
Yeah, that's right. And that's where a lot of the problems come from in marriage, that we don't see differences as acceptable. That's really sad. And I think it says something about how we understand the value of people. And I wonder whether a good thing isn't that we actually, when we meet people, we should be looking for the differences and learning how to value them, rather than seeing differences as a threat to us, which is what we... Christians tend to do that more often than non-Christians, I think. We tend to see the differences in other people as a threat. One of the things that I've noticed working on secular boards and secular committees and being able to differ with people very strongly and have them differ with each other and walk out of the meeting really good friends. But I've been in some Christian meeting, you wouldn't dare do that. You know, you wouldn't turn your back to them anyway when you went out. And that's really sad. I mean, of all people who should be able to do that, Christians should be able to do it. But we have problems with diversity. We have problems with differences, and we've got to learn to come to grips with that. Okay, let's stop, and have afternoon tea. Then we'll come back for our last session.